Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 12th, 2015. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Political Science from UC Berkeley, Wendy Brown. Undoing the Demos. Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution. Also on the program today, cloture vote in the Senate for the TPA at 2:30 this afternoon. Will the Senate pass this bill with 60 votes? Also on the program, millennials feeling it for socialism and Americans losing their religion slowly. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Sterling gets 3.5 years for leaking names of CIA operatives to James Risen, supposedly. Meanwhile, the Times gets a letter from just the most hilarious of advocates for more secrecy, at least one or two of whom not so great at keeping secrets, apparently. And Florida is sinking into the ocean, or rather, the ocean is rising over Florida, and their plan to deal with it is as follows. And that's the plan. More on that in the show. We should say Osama bin Laden, still dead, but the way in which he was killed by our government is unclear at this point, or I should say is generating some controversy. I don't have too much to say about the Cy Hurst story because I feel like we need to see more information come out. Cy Hurst, obviously, one of the nation's most esteemed investigative reporters, but this story in and of itself does not seem to be terribly sourced very well. Maybe there's other sources that he's not revealing to the reader, but from what he reveals, the sources seem pretty thin. Some parts, one part of the story, not a huge one, I should say, has been somewhat confirmed by NBC. They're reporting from multiple sources that the first tip off about Osama bin Laden came from basically a walk-in, and that the Pakistanis were aware of where he was located, which... Well, I don't know if that was particularly new. The story was that the Pakistanis were not aware of where he was. I always found that hard to believe. I always felt, you know, that Pakistan... I don't know if I said this on the air at the time, but I believe, when you're just speculating about these things, this is just pure conjecture on my part. that Pakistan had him for a while and was just making a deal. I think at the time, like, we're going to see the Pakistanis get a new nuclear program or something. Who knows? But, you know, as this story develops, as more information comes out, maybe we'll get into it. But it doesn't dramatically, in my mind, change the sort of the narrative, which I wasn't terribly pleased with in the first place, the idea that we would go in and just simply kill bin Laden and then as a country celebrate the fact that we killed this guy. I would have liked to have brought him back and stand trial. All right, be that as it may, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Wendy Brown, professor of political science from UC Berkeley, on her book, Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, professor of political science from UC Berkeley, Wendy Brown. Her latest book, Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution. Well, welcome to the program, Wendy.
Thanks very much, Sam.
So let's start. We've had a fair amount of conversations on this program about neoliberalism, and I want you to define it. But first, because it's so, I think, critical to the perspective you take on neoliberalism, define for us demos.
Sure. Demos is a Greek word, and it simply means the people. And it's at the very heart of our word, democracy. So our word comes from the ancient Greek, demos kratia. And kratia means rule. So democracy, in its original meaning, simply means the people rule.
And
okay. That's, you know, we have lots of other ways of understanding democracy. But at its heart, I think it, for all of us, it means the people, not some tyrant and not some other force and not some other power rule. And my concern with neoliberalism is, among other things, what it's doing to the idea of the people ruling.
And that that notion of its impact is not simply economic but political. Why don't you define neoliberalism for us, and how your perspective on this is a little bit more expansive than what we traditionally note as neoliberalism?
I'd be glad to. So, as you say, the kind of commonplace, if there is a commonplace understanding of neoliberalism, is that it's a set of economic policies that do everything from dismantle the welfare state to deregulate industry and finance and basically produce at least the idea of free trade and the free movement of capital everywhere. And it's involved a lot of other things, privatizing public institutions like universities and outsourcing a lot of public operations, including in the military and so forth. But neoliberalism usually is just understood that way. And what I think is important to realize is that the original neoliberals, Friedman, Hayek, some other intellectuals both in America and in Europe, and their followers, did want to argue for an anti-Keynesian, deregulated economic world, but they wanted to do something else. They wanted to formulate everything as markets, everything that humans do and everything that humans are in economic terms. And this is the world that's actually important to grasp when we're trying to think about something like democracy in everyday life, because when you take democracy or when you take education or when you take all kinds of features of being human and cast them only in economic terms, dramatic things happen. And one of the things that's happened to democracy is when we understand it as a marketplace and we no longer can understand it as a domain in which human beings have to come together in order to govern themselves, the very idea of the people falls apart, because markets don't have a people, they just have individual interests. And the very idea of things like educating for democracy, higher education being, among other things, to make an intelligent citizenry that can govern itself, also falls apart. Instead, education just becomes about individual investment in the individual in order to enhance one's own value as a little bit of human capital. So that's the brief version, and we can talk about any piece of it that you'd like to.
Well, and so when these guys are gathering at Mont Pelerin, I mean, was is that basically the project that we want to? I mean, was there a desire to usher in an economic system and an awareness that we want to? The best way to do that is to sort of usher in sort of a broader, I mean, this is where we get into sort of like the evolution of the economic man, right? Homo I can't even do it.
Economicus. It's a hard one to say. and it's an ugly word. Yes. So when they're gathering at places like Mont Pelerin, but also places like the University of Chicago, what they're excited by is not just the idea of chasing back what they understand to be the growing socialism being brought about by Keynesian policies, but also the idea of making the individual a market creature in every walk of life. And you saw this really clearly when Margaret Thatcher came to power, and one of her famous utterances was that the project was not just to change the economy, but the very soul of man. And what she meant, among other things, was the idea was to get rid of the notion that we were social, political creatures, but instead that we were simply individual entrepreneurs of our own life in every dimension of existence. Now, I'm not saying that each of these neoliberal architects was nefarious in their intentions. They really understood, as many of them do today, thinkers like Gary Becker, still at the University of Chicago, that this was the best way to bring about the best kind of world and the best kind of life for human beings. That if we think like market actors in every domain of life, we'll maximize our existence, our interests in every domain of life, whether we're thinking about family or education or any other dimension of existence, that's what we are. We should be homo economicus, and if we're not thinking that way, that's what we should be, because that's how you can make the best society. minimal government, minimal regulation, maximum individual endeavor and interest everywhere. But here's the problem. When you cast us like that, you get decisions like Citizens United.
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because the analysis.
We'll go there in a minute.
Yes, the analysis you did of Citizens United is fascinating to me, and I want to get into the sort of the notion of innovation and freedom and efficiency that you talk about because all of this. I mean, I guess part of the point is. I feel this on a daily basis just when I'm talking to my kid about, you know, her Instagram likes, frankly.
Right.
But before we get there, I just want to get a little bit more of a sense of just sort of the history.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the – was the sense coming out of these fathers, and I do mean fathers, of neoliberalism that – it is the natural state of man to be essentially a its own little business, right? Like that humans are economic in the way that they just are, and that to the extent that people don't realize it, it really is just they don't realize it, and they're not maximizing their efficiency, which they could be if they were more aware of it. In other words, was their project to turn people's into their vision, or rather just to make people aware of the fact that they are that?
So that's a wonderful question, because now you've entered into an argument among them. Some of them believed that we simply are homo economicus, that that's what we are, and even when we don't know that that's how we're acting, that's how we're acting. And that that's just all that human beings are, and all you had to do was get rid of all the junk in society, government, rules, regulations, and so forth, and just set out, you know, the most minimal kinds of protections against our thieving and stealing and hurting one another, and that was it. Others of them believed that markets were not natural, and that human beings are not necessarily naturally inclined in this way, but that it was the best organization of society. And so they're actually engaged in what we would call a very constructive project. That is, that you had to construct society and construct human beings in this way. So the Margaret Thatcher remark, the idea was not just to change society, but change the very soul of man, comes down on that second side, where she's following Hayek, who understands human beings as needing to be shaped in this direction because it's what makes them free and makes the best society. But others, like Friedman, think, oh, you just, you know, take away all the structures that inhibit this, we'll just do it naturally. It's a more kind of original Adam Smith notion. This is just who we are. But I would say today what you see in certainly most North American, Euro-Atlantic worlds, Europe and the United States and Canada is an effort at constructing us like this, turning us into good market creatures in every domain of life. Not where somebody's pulling the strings, you know, and masterminding this, but rather through practices of governance that make us into entrepreneurs of our own life. And again, I think education's a really good example where anyone who's got a teenager knows that these kids are, you know, building their resumes from the time they're 12, if they're middle class students, trying to, you know, be the most valuable creature that a college could possibly look at, and in turn in college are interning for free and doing this and that in order to become maximally valuable to a future employer. They're always working on enhancing their value, and that had to be constructed. That wasn't just there. It wasn't what you and I did when we were kids. It had to be shaped and organized by institutions and by essentially defunding higher education as well.
And I want to get to that dynamic, and we see that all the time. And I think I don't even remember who it was necessarily that just in the past couple of weeks basically just said like we should was subscribing to that notion of where we should charge extra if you're getting a liberal arts education, that type of thing. That
right.
That's a luxury good.
Right.
But before we get there, just getting back to, so there's two different I guess ideas that are coming out of those original neoliberals. And mm-hmm. is it the second, the one that you described by Thatcher, Thatcher holding that perspective, or Hayek, that we need a strong state to create that environment? That it's not
right.
necessarily. Just tell us that sort of distinction there
right.
as well.
So I wasn't imagining that you would be asking for all these details. It's quite great.
We try and get very also, weedy here.
That you do. Crazy. You get down in it. So there's also a difference here between those who argue for a very minimal state, as you suggested, just providing the barest ground rules, as Milton Friedman argued, and those who say, nope, you actually need to organize competition. Competition's good. It brings out the best in everything. And what you have to do to organize it is to construct conditions in which people will be competitive in particular spheres. So that requires not just a strong state, but a state that actually is busily producing competitive environments that wouldn't otherwise exist, and is going to have other kinds of involvements as well. And that state becomes very compatible with a state that on the one hand deregulates capital, but on the other hand has very elaborate legislative as well as other policy orientations toward everything from what we're seeing today, free trade agreements that are actually not quite free trade agreements.
Right, I mean, that TPP is that's a perfect
thousands
example,
of
right?
pages of structure, yes. But also the ways, for example, financial aid is being structured or restructured by the state, being allocated to those institutions that are going to be ranked as offering the highest return on investment. So financial aid isn't just going to be dispersed in a kind of, you know, random way to any student on the basis of need, but rather is trying to incite competition among various universities to run the cheapest operation and give the most bang for the buck. And the billions of $1.2 billion in federal financial aid will be dispersed according to a very complex algorithm based on those rankings and ratings of various universities. So that's the more elaborated state that's still totally involved with the economy and with seeding competition and with enhancing the possibilities of capital accumulation, but isn't hands-off, isn't minimalist, the way the Friedman state was imagined to be.
And so let's talk about before we get to the question that really sort of I'm obsessed with is sort of that we have the structure that is being set up, right? I mean, and it's quite clear how that works with the example you just gave with higher education.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be able to get money, and it's going to be easier for you to go to a college that is going to get you a job that's going to make you more money.
Right.
And so necessarily it creates advantages and incentives for certain types of education that cut away from, I'm going to be a well-rounded citizen. Sorry, there's no way that we can actually put a number on that figure, and so that is going to be devalued.
Exactly.
That dynamic is pretty clear, I think. But how is it that it is, we're seeing it, and maybe we're jumping ahead, but heck with it. But how is it that we're seeing neoliberalism creep into everything so, it seems, almost organically at times? Like, I mean, I guess I could come up with the idea that, well, Facebook came from a guy who went to Harvard who was sort of bathed in this notion of, like, this kid was very aware, I got to have the extracurriculars, so I get into Harvard, I got to get my GPA, so I got to get into Harvard. And then, he's bathed in these ideas of, like, if you get a certain amount of likes, you're going to be, you're creating a currency there, and you're projecting a fully optimized social entrepreneurial projection out there to get more likes and friends. I mean, is that how it happens, or?
Well, I think that's one dimension of how it happens. I think that, you know, I think what's complicated with something like neoliberalism is that it's operating both as a set of policies, and as you just suggested, it's also operating as a form of reason or common sense that we do imbibe, we do absorb, but that also itself becomes part of the way that every development, every institution, every endeavor gets structured. And I think it's important to be able to see both, to see that the economic policies get set in motion and didn't have to be set in motion with that form of reason also becoming ubiquitous. And I'd also put it the other way around. You can have the form of reason. You can have the idea that everything is only a market and actually make a decision that you're going to have some state-owned industry. And you can, you know, even if you say everything is only a market, you can actually have some what some would call non-neoliberal economic policies. But when these two work together, the way they're working together now, I think you don't have to see the Facebook inventor as understanding at the outset all the ways in which Facebook itself would develop the capital value of its users.
Right.
That is, Facebook starts as a social networking site that, you know, you can say, oh, I see some capital value in that. That's going to help people just to network. But what you just mentioned, the idea of likes and retweets and favorites on retweets and so forth, all of that is what neoliberalism as a form of reason adds to the app, as it were, in no time as it begins to develop. So that what you get now, and I just want to pause over this point, is a shift from the entrepreneurial subject, the subject who's simply supposed to take all of its assets and entrepreneurialize them at every turn, to what we could call the human capital subject, the subject who's just trying to enhance its value as a little bit of human capital. And the difference here really matters, and it matters because it marks a shift from entrepreneurial or productive capitalism to what we have today, which is finance capitalism. And with finance capitalism, what matters is your value in the present and in the speculative future. That's what makes anybody's value go up and down, how investors imagine your value might go in the future. And we know that. We just, you know, we see the stock market move up and down based on what speculators every day imagine is going to happen to a particular entity, including Greece. And that means that human beings now get their credit or credibility or capital value out of investors, even if they're not real monetary investors, their likes or their retweets or their favorited tweets or their rankings and ratings based on a whole range of other things, from Yelp to Moody's. And that's shifted what neoliberalism has become. So I just went into a long story here that isn't identical with the story of neoliberalism, but it means that neoliberalism today circulates an understanding of the human being in which what matters is human beings' capital value, human capital value, as it's understood in a financialized way, in a way that has to do with whether potential investors see you as having sufficient value to invest in you. And that, of course, is why things like free internships have become so important to young people, and why resume building itself becomes not just a way to get return on your investment, but to enhance your appearance as valuable to those who might invest in you.
And so, all right, so I'm that change, that notion of, like, I guess on some level it's like you've enumerated a couple of things. Even just like when I give a follow Friday on Twitter, I'm basically
right.
saying, like, hey, you know, not only should you follow this person for what they've done in the past, but I'm also implying that I think they're going to do this again in the future, and they're going to provide you good content, and I'm going to get some cash from the recommendation.
And as soon as you do that, you've enhanced their value so that others start paying attention. And that's how that world works, is that as soon as you've upped their value, then others start responding to that value, and then that value moves on a roll.
And just to be clear, the financialization aspect of it is that person is no more valuable on the ground, as it were. But within this sort of marketplace, there's more value associated with them that has been almost sort of leveraged.
Exactly. And that, the story this week is Uber selling for potentially $40 billion. When it actually doesn't turn a profit, and you think, well, how can that be? How does that work exactly? And what's being invested in and speculated about is its future value, and that's of course the very meaning of a startup, that it hasn't yet made money, but that it is expected to, if investors invest, if you can attract investors. And that, in turn, is precisely what allows it to be valued at a certain level. So the gap is growing between profitability and value, which is itself fascinating. But it also means that human beings get configured in the same way, that what matters is not your immediate return on investment, but what something produces in the way of value that looks like would be attractive to investors, and that investors will then make real for you.
I want to get back to that notion of when Facebook is being developed. I don't think he anticipated, or the developers of Facebook anticipated, where it would go. But it seems to me that it was set on a track, right? That it sort of that with certain assumptions at the beginning and a basic foundation that would logically lead to where it has gone in this respect, and
it's hard not to see it that way now. I completely agree,
but can you imagine? I guess the question is: can you imagine a Facebook constructed as the way it was? I guess now only 11 years ago, scarily,
right.
But that went a different way. That somehow, I don't know, functioned in a different way.
I think if you can imagine a social networking site, which maybe Friendster, the precursor to Facebook, is the example. Remember Friendster?
Vaguely.
It was way back. But yeah, exactly, vaguely. Which was literally just about collections of friends. But it was before, I want to suggest, the sort of financialized revolution in the human being. And so I can imagine a social networking site that was more about connecting people for, let me put it this way, something closer to LinkedIn, which was about connecting people for their potential entrepreneurial exploitation of their connections, of their networks, rather than their kind of social value that in turn could also turn into more general human capital value. So I can imagine it, but I think at this point it's a thought experiment that's probably not even too worth having,
right,
because of the direction, as you've pointed out, that Facebook took. But I don't think, the Facebook inventors were actually going in this direction. I don't think they were imagining that they would control the market in human capital value.
Right, and
that was not their their aim.
Right. No, but and we're just using them obviously as an example, as just a way,
right,
of sort of like boiling this down a little bit. I mean, one of,
right,
the things that you said in terms of like creating this broader environment, a guy like Alan Greenspan, not coincidentally, obviously an acolyte of Friedman's, mm-hmm, said at one point that part of his job was to create a certain amount of anxiety, I think, about amongst sort of like to create a certain amount of
in
employment.
In the market.
And in employment, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And
right,
the idea being is that once it's not, you cannot take it for granted that I'm going to have a job, the idea of maximizing yourself for profit becomes very, very important. And it's also sort of created, I think, like, I listened to a podcast the other day just sort of randomly by the guy who does that 4-hour work week or 4-hour diet thing or whatever it is. And this data-driven mentality, which we also see now in journalism, and we see it across across the spectrum of things. It revolutionized baseball in some ways. This data-driven mentality is sort of founded on this notion of we have to become as efficient as possible because we can't afford to. And to listen to these guys talk about like, well, I eat the exact same thing every day. It only takes me 3.3 minutes to cook the breakfast so that I can go on and do other things that will enhance me as sort of, as an economic being.
That's right. And here it's really important for us to remember that the economic being is now no longer simply monetized. And this is, I think, the hardest thing for us to get our heads around. When we just, think about economics, we think money. And what we're talking about, once all activity and all social arrangements are economized, is a series of, put it this way, we're now talking about enhancing our value in every domain, even where it's not monetized. So dating websites are a very good example. On the one hand, the high-end dating sites will constantly appeal to new clientele by saying, we can make this whole process more efficient, less wasted time on dates that don't work out, and so on and so forth. We do all the screening. We make sure the match is right. But what they are also doing in their appeals is structuring your value, as it were, and your profile in a way that has to do with finding a match that is not exactly about wealth enhancement or reducing actual financial investment in the process. It's about maximizing your value in this particular domain, love or dating or marriage or whatever you want to call it. So it's an economization of the process there that isn't directly about money. And that's what I think we see from Facebook to Instagram to, right, as you say, approaches to exercise. It's about, ways titrating every dimension of exercise from intake to output to body to the 6-minute workout and so forth, to be not just to save ourselves from money making, but to approach everything we do as a maximum value for minimum input.
And so let's turn to your analysis of Citizens United, because this is it's fascinating, and it shows how sort of like these things that we're talking about are a training ground to sort of to get our mode of thought consistent with sort of a market approach to everything, which where necessarily other values values in terms of maybe qualities are disregarded and become less valuable because they don't directly tie into sort of this market mentality. Talk about what you found in Citizens United that people, sometimes miss when they talk about corporations as people.
So I think the common progressive lament about Citizens United, or outrage more than a lament, is that it's understood as something that made corporations into people with free speech rights, said those rights are unlimited, and on the basis of that tortured argumentation, said there should be no limits on spending for super PACs from corporations. And, the bottom line is, what did that do? It allowed corporate money to simply flood the American electoral process. And American electoral process, as we know, was already not in very good shape. It was already compromised both by party structures on the one hand and by extensive campaign spending on the other. So then we get a decision 4 years ago that says, okay, lift the gates, let the corporations have their way. And I would add, combine that with the fact that we have steadily reduced the amount of money that legislation, House of Representatives and senators have for staffing, which has essentially meant that lobbyists are more and more writing the legislation that legislators then consider because they just don't have the staffers to develop the legislative bills anymore. You combine flooding the electoral process with corporate money and corporations actually writing legislation, you basically have a country run by corporations. But what I want to suggest is that if you read Citizens United closely, you see something even worse than that. What you see is a jurisprudence, a way of interpreting the Constitution that is exactly what we've been talking about. It is something that sees the Constitution and sees rights and sees democracy in purely economic terms. And it does this in the following way. What you get in Justice Kennedy's opinion is a treatment of speech as nothing more than a way of enhancing your position in what he calls the electoral or political marketplace. Not speech as a way of human beings deliberating with one another or political speech as something that has to be carefully protected from being monopolized by the very powerful. All that goes away. Instead, he simply treats speech as something that you essentially use as a way of enhancing your position, like any other capital would use anything to enhance their position. And he says, look, the fact that winners in the economic marketplace, corporations, might be a little more powerful in the political marketplace, elections, not much we can do about that because we believe in free markets everywhere. The political marketplace should be free. The economic marketplace should be free. If everything's a marketplace and speech is one of the ways that you use, one of the things you use to enhance your competitive positioning, well, then we just need to take all the restrictions off and set the corporations loose. And that's the reasoning, perverse as it sounds, that's the reasoning at the heart of Citizens United. And it means that really basic things like the idea of political corruption just vanish from the decision. He talks about corruption, but he says, you know, as long as no politician's actually being bribed, there's no possibility of corruption when, as he puts it, a corporation just spends a lot of money on an election because nobody's being bribed. It's just there's a lot of money being spent. So all of the classic concerns in democracy about the voice of the people being something you have to make sure that you enhance in order for the people to really rule, and that you have to keep other powers at bay to make sure that the people really rule, all that vanishes. So the bottom line is far more than just allowing corporations the standing of people and allowing corporations to flood the electoral process, Citizens United is one in a string of Supreme Court decisions that says there's nothing anywhere except economic reasoning and economic entities. And rights are not civil rights, they're not political rights, they're just powers that everybody should have. And, you know, the most recent example of that is actually in a whole other domain, which is Hobby Lobby, the decision that allows Christian-owned corporations to withhold certain kinds of health insurance for reasons pertaining to religion, anything that has to do with abortifacients or abortions. And there the argument was corporations ought to have freedom of religion. They have conscience. So now they have speech, they have conscience, they have freedom of religion. One can assume they will soon have the freedom to assemble and probably the right to bear arms. In other words, corporations and people are, there's no distinction. They're just both entities that have rights, and rights are simply ways of enhancing your position in the marketplace.
Right, as opposed to existing for other reasons, those reasons being
political. About enhancing democracy, about people being able to be empowered as individuals and as a group to rule their own lives. And instead, that has just vanished.
Okay, so let's. I want to just see if we have answered the question, and I think to obviously not fully completely. We need to read the book to do that. But I mean, you ask at one point in your book, how does the distinctive form of reason that is neoliberalism become a governing rationality, saturating the practices of ordinary institutions and discourses of everyday life? And part of that is it is written in it's adopted by a guy who writes a very prominent Supreme Court decision. Part of it is Alan Greenspan saying, if I keep everybody a little bit nervous about whether or not they have a job, they're going to necessarily, just for the sake of survival, I guess, default to a position where they can only afford to do things and pursue things that will make them a more marketable entity in that will commodify themselves in some fashion.
Right. And but then part of it is something else, and I think this is what you're pointing toward. A part of it is that the more of our public institutions and nonprofits and community organizations, the more they borrow from business in the way that they manage and govern themselves, the more they start to spread this form of reason. And there's no better place to see this than in public universities.
And but, I would say and increasingly in public education.
Exactly. That everywhere what's happening at the management level is that best practices are being borrowed from business to seed competition, to make operations lean and mean.
This is devolution, right?
And to treat every individual as a bit of human capital. Our former president of the system of the University of California, the 10-campus system here, simply referred to UC as generating bits of human capital. And it's not just that it's an ideology, it's that when that becomes part of the way that an institution like the University of California is structured, then students start understanding themselves that way, faculty understand themselves that way, administrators understand that, you know, what they're doing is trying to produce everything from enhanced ratings and rankings for the schools themselves by doing all kinds of crazy things like increasing the number of applicants every year for admission, even though you're going to turn away more and more of them. But why do you increase the applicants? Because that's what increases your own rankings. The more selective you are, the higher ranked the institution is. So,
and that's why you see spending on, instead of on teachers, you see it on building a new student union, because
exactly.
That's
new going student to union, new stadium, new swimming facilities, and so forth. And there's several reasons for that. One has to do with the difference between capital investments and students, but the other is, as you say, attractiveness, ratings, rankings, you know, how you keep those ratings and rankings and attractiveness up. And so what gets lost there, of course, is the question, you know, what are we educating for? What should we be teaching? What does an educated citizen need? And instead, what you're trying to do also is steer students more and more, as you said 20 minutes ago, toward those majors that will maximize their income at the other end, which means business, engineering, information sciences, and obviously away from those majors that we classically associate not just with the humanities and arts, but with any aspect of a broad liberal arts education. So that's how it seeps into institutions. It comes in through all kinds of different pores, but especially through divesting public funding from them that then makes them, the institutions themselves, have to be more entrepreneurial, and in turn makes them also borrow from, or leads them increasingly to borrow from, business practices and understanding what they do and how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I guess now a year ago we must have had Barbara Maldaloni, I think her name is. She's the new, she was at the time the new head of the teachers union in Massachusetts. And she was arguing that public schools has become sort of the final frontier for the neoliberal project. And
I think that's right.
We're bumping up against time. There was still a couple of things I wanted to ask you, and one listener had asked asked you, wanted me to ask about your writings on resentment and identity politics from the 90s, which I'm not familiar with, unfortunately. They wanted to ask how your Nietzschean analysis of politics based on trauma applies today. I don't think we're going to be able to get the answer right now.
I don't think we are either. Let me just say this for the listener. In the 90s, my concern was very much with identity politics and not so much with neoliberalism. I do think there's some connections, but one of the things I do, and I think most writers on politics we respect, is try not to keep repeating ourselves, but stay with the times. And so I think neoliberalism is the problem of our time, two problems of our time, climate change and neoliberalism. And they're as Naomi Klein has well said, on a collision course, or they're perfectly synergistic would be the dark way of putting it. But what I was working on in the 90s hasn't gone away, but it's not at the forefront for me now.
Well, I would love to continue this conversation about the neoliberalism. There's still some stuff I've left on the page, but I want to thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam, and thanks for the quality and the depth of your questions. It was really great.
Oh, well, my pleasure. We will, of course, link to your book at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Great. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wendy Brown, professor of political science, Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution. Fascinating stuff. And I see it, you know, with Myla in particular. I mean, you know, we do that here, but we have a product. I mean, it gets a little bit cloudy because on some level, you know, we're the product. But Myla and her likes on Instagram. And I don't know what the answer is, but a notion of sort of somehow taking the pressure off of the way that people live, right? I mean, the reason why, you know, you start to see, I mean, Tom Hartman has, I think, an entire book, Screwed, I think it is, that talks about the pushback from capital and the concern that capital had that there was too much power being accrued as in the 60s by sort of the middle class, political power. And I know some people suggest that the pushback at that time was because capital was realizing that they were getting a diminished return on investment, that their basically their profit margins were going down slightly. But certainly when you had the great compression, as they call it, from in the post-war era, where one person could be providing for a family and people were not terribly concerned about losing their jobs. Now, granted, obviously a different world because a huge percentage of Americans weren't really allowed to compete for those jobs. But nevertheless, and frankly, the world wasn't allowed to compete for those jobs. Nevertheless, there was a security which allowed people to start to take political power. And so you degrade that financial security, that economic security, and then all of a sudden, I don't really have time to go protest this thing because I've got to maximize the amount of work I can get done and that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So interesting stuff. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, where we're going to talk about the TPP cloture vote. Jesus. Oh, my God. I thought today was going to be light. The number is 646-257-3920. Folks, this program relies on your support. for 98% of its revenue. And I say 98% because I think we're going to do a Credo promotion starting by the end of the week for a month. But I don't know if it'll make 2%, but it may make 2% for us. So you can support this program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this program by giving us a review on iTunes. Yeah, it actually makes a difference. At least it does in my mood sometimes.
And believe me, that helps too.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Also, you can support this program by buying your Amazon crap. If you buy it from Amazon, the very least you can do is buy it from our link or through our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, use that as your Amazon, and we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, now with free shipping. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Play the music, man. 646-257-3920. Oh, don't forget, we got a free app. Free app. Free app. And via that free app, you can listen to the show, you can search the show. You can look for other interviews we've done on neoliberalism. You can IM the show. Oh. Yes, Michael. Oh, yes, the Jay-Z. Quote, I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman. Well, that's not the quote you sent me. You said, I'm a businessman. We'll be right back.